50s on 5, keeping the Big Beat Jive alive. Matt the Cat, where it's at, baby. It is Doo-Wop Thursday as we feature an extra heaping helping of Doo-Wop records throughout the night. But the special feature of the evening is here. It is a pleasure to bring on the air one of the original members of the Aquatones, Dave Goddard. Dave, hello.
Hello, Matt.
It is good to talk to you, man.
Well, it's about time we communicated live voice, I think.
I know it's we've been emailing back and forth for quite a while now, and actually, I think the first time you and I did start corresponding was well over a year ago.
I'd say it was probably end of 2006. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's great to have you on the show, and it really is an honor because, I mean, you were part of one of those type of doo-wop groups that everyone remembers. I mean, You by the Aquatones is one of those songs that Night Prowlers request all the time, and it's one that always makes, you know, doo-wop fans top 10 lists, and certainly it was a hit record. And
wow.
So it's just, it's great, and you were a part of that. I mean, that must be... all these 50 years later, I mean, you know, how's that feel?
It was just about 50 years later, and of course it seems like yesterday, Matt.
Of course it does.
I mean, I'm marginally older than I was then, but
we won't
get too deeply into that.
Right. Well, I think the best place to start is always the beginning. And so what I'd like to know is basically before you even started, you know, before the Aquatones were formed, what got you interested in music, interested in singing? What was you know, what influenced you back then?
Well, if you go way back,
what's your first memory of a record or a song on the radio or something?
Oh, song on the radio. Okay, I was gonna say my mother played piano, my father played violin, so I had some music in the family. But if you get to the radio, your hit parade. On radio. I discovered that program in February of 1950. Mm-hmm. And I don't imagine that you're old enough to remember, Matt, but but they had the top seven songs sung not by the hit artists, but by their own captive singers.
Oh, yeah.
And
they're captive. Their own captives, so yes, they couldn't escape.
Right. But for some reason, I was so fascinated by that. By not only the music, Matt, but the statistics.
Sure.
I wrote down every week's top seven songs every single Saturday night from early February until mid-October 1950. And the only reason I stopped was that Your Hit Parade went off radio and on to television, and my parents didn't get a television until 1956.
Ooh, that was late. They were late adopters of that technology.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's great. Good musical memory. So that got you interested. Obviously, you're interested in the charts and that's,
oh, yeah, the
that
charts
side of it.
And, and the music itself. And there was kind of a gap in there between 50 and 53. And then sometime, I think it was around April. And oh, by the way, Matt, I still have that notebook that I wrote everything down in.
Amazing.
And around 53, I discovered a program on WABC AM out of New York City called Martin Block's Make Believe Ballroom.
Sure.
And on Saturday morning, Martin used to run down typically the top 24.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally, I started writing all those down, and I have about a year and a half of that stuff from early 53 to late 54. And about 54, late fall of 54, is when Alan Freed hit New York, mm-hmm. and the whole thing changed.
And you were grown up on Long Island at this point?
Yes, sir, I was.
Okay.
Valley Stream, Long Island.
And you remember when Alan Freed hit Winds?
Oh, yes, I do. Oh, yes, I do. As a matter of fact, sometime that winter, 53 or 54. Oh, here's another blast from the past for anybody from the, at least from the New York area and maybe beyond that. Does the name GM Motorama mean anything to you?
Doesn't mean anything to me.
Yeah, doesn't mean, it was the showing by General Motors of all, not only their new cars, but their dream cars.
Ah.
And they would have this big show in New York City at, oh, wherever it was, I don't remember, the old Madison Square Garden, Waldorf, I'm not sure. But at any rate, there was about four of us kids from ninth grade that went into New York City, to CGM Motorama for that year, and it was all the 1954 models, I remember that. And afterwards, one of the guys says, hey, why don't we stop over at Wynn's and see if we can speak to Alan Freed?
Oh.
So we walked over there, and I think he went on the air around 7 o'clock. And we walked in, and we sat around and waited, and sure enough, he showed up. And when he first showed up, he was, like, reading his mail. He was very quiet. I mean, he wasn't brusque. He just wasn't very talkative. And I guess we chatted with him a little bit, told him what big fans of his show we were, blah, blah, blah. And he was still fairly quiet. But we left after he'd just been on the air a few minutes. And on the air, he was a totally different person.
Mm-hmm.
He used to pound on the Queen's phone book for a drum. And, man, we looked in, you know, into the studio, and he's grinning ear to ear and waving goodbye at us and everything. He was into it by then.
Yeah. Wow, did you go to any of these shows at the Brooklyn Fox or Brooklyn Paramount?
Yep. I like to say the first one I went to, I stood in line in a snowstorm for 6 hours. Actually, to be truthful,
yeah,
it was flurrying.
Okay.
But it was December of, must have been, I'm going to say 55 maybe, but honest to goodness, we were online from 9 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon.
Do you remember who you saw?
Pardon?
Do you remember who you saw that day?
One of the times, but I think it was a year later or so, Fats Domino was the headliner.
Mm-hmm. First show?
The first show...
That's a long time ago.
A long time ago. Yeah. I'm quite sure I saw the Cleftones at one of the shows.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is another little note I could put in too, Matt. On one of the shows, one of the acts was George Hamilton IV, who had a hit with Rose and a Baby Ruth at that
time. Yeah.
So if I were to get, you know, real studious and look up the year, I could tell you, you know, about what show.
Right.
But it was so weird because he's on the show and he has on a charcoal black suit and a white shirt and a nice neat knit tie, all right?
Mm-hmm.
All these other groups on there, you know, be it the Cleftones or whoever else was on, you know, yellow tuxedos, pink tuxedos, you know. And I said to myself somewhere along there, if I ever have a hit record, you know, with the group, because I was with the group with the Aquatones already, I said, we ever have a hit record, boy, we'll show them that we kids from the suburbs can dress like these crazy rock and rollers, too.
Wow.
Well, that was before Lou Fargo discovered us, became our manager, and we wore conservative jackets and nice button-down shirts. Bummer.
But growing up around New York, it must have been great with all the music going on around there and the times and rock and roll coming in. I mean, that was the place to be, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, having had no experience of growing up anywhere else, I can tell you it was a very exciting time to be a teenager, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So who came up with the name Aquatones and what's the,
that was about our third name, Matt.
Cause, you know, you look at the groups at the time and you had your car groups and your bird groups and stuff, but Aquatones really stands out because, you know, it's not a common vocal group type of a name, you know what I mean?
Well, I can tell. Well, actually, the tones at the end of it,
sure.
Cleft tones,
yep.
And I don't remember if the monotones were before us or after
us. They were after you.
Okay. Give me some other tones, babe.
The mellow tones?
Oh, yeah. Anyway,
the time tones?
Yeah. At any rate.
But water. But that's the time. Tones is one thing, musical, but water. It's like musical water.
No. It had nothing to do with water. Although Gene of our group always used to claim that it came from the fact we sang in bathrooms. But never
so it's the color. It's the color.
Yeah,
aqua.
It is the color. You see, they had just come out with a cool new shirt for guys, okay? I had an Aqua shirt that I wore to school, okay? But they came out with an even brighter one. It was really more turquoise than aqua, but, I mean, you couldn't say turquoise tones. I mean, come on, you trip over it.
The chartreuse tones.
Yeah, right. No, this was like an aqua shirt with a black velvet collar.
Ooh.
And a black velvet V down the front, okay?
Oh, yeah.
So at one of our rehearsals, and this was in early July of 57, I said to the group, I says, hey, what do you say we go out and all of us guys get that shirt, and then we can change our name to the Aquatones in honor of the Aqua shirt? And that's how it happened.
Well, there you go. Not too many vocal groups based on, you know, fashion trends. I'm sure I could think of a few if I sit here and do that, but that wasn't common. So there you go. You're already standing out from the pack right from the beginning.
Oh, there you go.
All right, so you guys are singing together. You got your name. Well, what were the two other names? Do you remember?
Yes. Well, the first one wasn't a real name, and I'll only tell the story if you ask me. But we started off using the name Rhythm Kings just because it was about as generic a rock and roll band name as you could come up with.
Yeah, sure.
And then that was too generic for us. So we changed our name for a while to the Streamers because we were from Valley Stream. Oh, boy. Anyway, that isn't exactly
fire,
but we were the Streamers for a while.
It was after that
and being somewhat underwhelmed by that name that I thought of the Aquatones idea.
Okay. All right. Now, did everyone play an instrument in the band?
Everybody except Lynn. We also had a non-singing drummer, Bob Bowden. But Larry and Gene both played sax. I played piano. Bob played drums. And Lynn sang.
Great. Well, you know, a lot of the groups had to have studio musicians when they went to record. So you guys actually recorded?
No.
Oh, you had studio musicians as well?
No. When Lou Fargo discovered us, he was very emphatic. He just wanted a vocal group.
I see.
So our drummer kind of left. And he's a great guy, and I kind of refer to him as the peak best of the Aquatones.
Okay, well, let's talk about the beginnings of the Aquatones then, the members of the group, and how you guys got together.
Okay. Starting my sophomore year in high school, I had started writing some early versions of what I could call rock and roll songs, having been inspired by what I heard on Alan Freed, okay? And I guess some of my reasonably close friends knew I wrote music. Well, early in my junior year, a classmate and buddy of mine came up to me because we were putting on our junior class play that year. And it was called John Loves Mary. And this friend of mine named Greg Galena came up to me during class one time, and he had written down some lyrics on a sheet of paper. His idea was to write a song about John Loves Mary and use that song as part of the publicity for our junior class play. Okay? So I looked at the words that Greg had written, and I have the sheet of paper somewhere around. I fully intend to use it as blackmail against Mr. Galena at some point in his life. But it was, let's see. John loves Mary. Mary loves John. Let's fall in love, darling. We'll be real gone. I love you, and I always will. Be true. Ooh-hoo. Ooh-hoo. Ooh-hoo.
Classic.
Yes. Well, I guess. Anyway.
It was a hit, though. It was a hit around the school.
Well, what happened, Matt, was I was reading the lyrics, and I knew they needed a little help. But that one line that caught me was the, you know I love you, and I always will.
Ah, yes.
And in my mind, it came out with the bass singer repeat. As in, you know I love it, I love it, I love it, and I always will, I will, I will. Okay,
yeah.
So I wound up writing the song, and I had a good buddy that I was in marching band with. His name was Larry Venata. Now, Larry played sax, which was in those days always needed in any rock and roll up-tempo song.
Of course.
But best of all, Larry had a tape recorder. Ooh. RCA reel-to-reel with a one-inch diameter microphone, okay?
Oh, nice.
So I asked Larry if he would come over to my house September 26, 1956. It was the day before my 16th birthday. And record the John Loves Mary rock, okay? Larry showed, and oh, the other thing was, Larry and I had kidded around, and it sounded like he could sing bass. So I said, great, Larry and I can pull this off. Well, Larry shows up at the door, and he's got his buddy Gene McCarthy with him. Now, Gene was also in marching band. I knew him to say hello to, but apparently Larry knew him better. Gene played clarinet. Larry played sax. I played piano. Drums, hey, we had a tin can around. My parents had some old gourds, so they pounded on the tin can, and that was our drum. Gene turned out to be a better singer than Larry, so he did the I love it part.
Yeah.
Okay? I recorded a lead-in monologue, trying my 15-year-old best to sound like Alan Freed, and failing miserably, but it's kind of funny to listen to it today. And at any rate, honest to goodness, it was played over the school public address system the next day. Then we got Bob Bowden, our buddy who was a drummer, to play with. So we played at the publicity skit for the play. And, yeah, that's how it started. How did Lynn get in? One of our other classmates, his father was a record distributor. So after Larry and Gene and I, with Bob playing drums, had recorded, you know, our two biggest hits, read that, the only two songs I'd written for that group, and we played them for this guy that was the record distributor. And he says to us, you know, you guys could use a high voice in the group.
Hmm.
Okay? So we were kind of on the lookout for somebody that could sing high. And then I guess I wasn't involved in this, but I guess there was a dance at the neighboring town that Larry went to. And at that dance, he met Lynn. And, you know, hey, come on, man, this is the 50s. It's, you know, we were teenagers. No, but at any rate, I guess probably Larry, knowing him, played big man, you know, that he was in a rock group and blah, blah,
oh,
blah, blah.
Sure, yeah.
And Lynn says, well, I sing. And so they start talking. You know, that's a good lead-in line as any, right?
Yep.
So at any rate, he checked with me and Gene and said, would it be okay if I brought Lynn over, see how she sounds with us? And Gene and I said, sure, bring it on, you know. So Lynn came over as a background singer until Larry wrote the song You for her to sing. And at the time we recorded our first record, Boys and Girls, You was the only song that Lynn sang lead on.
Right.
So we had to do a quick scurry up and find follow-up after that.
So how did Lou Fargo hear you?
Ah, it was when we lost the talent show, Matt.
Ah, okay.
Ah, yes. Stairway to Stardom, November 2nd, I believe it was, 1957. We were on a talent show at Malvern High School, next town over from Valley Stream. And we were playing instruments still, but, you know, during backstage while the rest of the acts were on, there was another five-person vocal group. I think they may have been singing a cappella, I'm not sure. But they were singing, and we were vocally jamming along with them, and, you know, they sounded good. We sounded good. We're thinking, gee, I wonder which one of us is going to win. And, of course, at the end of the show, they announced the winners, and neither one of us won anything, you know. So that was about our second or third talent show we'd been on. And afterwards, we were backstage, read that, the high school cafeteria, packing up our instruments, trying to figure out, okay, when's the next talent show coming up? And somebody, I don't remember if it was in our group or one of the other kids back there, gets my attention and said, hey, there's a man over by the door waving to you. So I look up, and I see this rather heavy-set gentleman in a big top coat and a huge grin on his face, waving to me to come over. So I walked over. I said, yes. And he looks at me. He says, how'd you like to make a record?
Was he chomping on a cigar when he did that?
You know, I've been asked that before. And the truth of the matter is, he told us that back in the day when this could happen, he had been taking a cigar break in the lobby of the high school when we came on. He came back in for the last four bars of She's the One for Me, which is, of course, the flip of You,
right.
Liked what he heard, and that's why he came up to us.
He must have read that in the manual of how to be a record label owner.
He didn't have a record label. He was our manager. He was going to try to promote us to some label.
Oh,
and
so
he said, if I can't place you, I'll start my own record company. I'll spell my name backwards or something.
So he
started his own record company and spelled his name forward. Okay.
Okay, that works.
It's his label. He can do what he wants, I guess, right?
Did he ever actually shop you around, or did he just throw his hands up and start a record label anyway?
There is a lot that we don't know about what Lou Fargo did. I suspect he had some contacts within the industry, even though he was just starting out. But, I mean, the guy was not stupid. He was a heck of a businessman. And I suspect he asked around, and he probably got a... You know, there was so much new talent back then.
Yeah.
You know, I suspect that he wasn't getting anywhere as fast as he wanted to get there. And so he said, nuts to this noise. I want to be in the business. Might as well jump in with both feet.
These are the deep, dark mysteries of Lou Fargo.
Oh, there are many more of those.
What went on late at night? As Lou sits and contemplates the future.
Hey, that would make a wonderful, Peter Lorre used to be on a show called Nightmare.
Yeah. Yes. that would work.
Yeah, right.
Lou Fargo.
The name.
Just the name even, It was a dark, cold night. Lou Fargo emerges from the darkness. All right, so She's the One for Me. That was the A side of the single.
You noticed that?
Yeah.
It actually was. No, actually, Lou was. Pardon me, Mr. Fargo.
No, that's right.
Yeah. Oh, geez. There's even a story about that. 20 years later, Larry had to get in touch with Fargo about something, and he'd left a message for him. You know?
Uh-huh.
So when Fargo calls him back, Larry thinks, hey, you know, I'm in my 40s. What the heck?
Right.
And he says, how you doing, Lou? And he's, hi, Larry, this is Mr. Fargo. Okay.
The formalities never cease.
Yeah. No. So what were you asking me?
I was asking you about She's the One for Me. That was the A side.
Yeah, Lou was promoting She's the One for Me in New York and was promoting You in Philadelphia. And he told us at the time, he said, if I get the record to break in either city, whichever side breaks, I'll have everybody flip it over and play that side.
Okay.
So that's what happened. It broke in Philly first.
So She's the One for Me. How did that song come about?
Well, I wrote it. I wrote it the summer of 57. And I think there's a line there. There is kind of an actually funny story on myself. I guess it must have been the girls I knew on Long Island. Most of them had dark hair and dark eyes. And I was down at the Jersey Shore at the beginning of the summer. And they used to have record hops up over the old movie theater on the boardwalk where we were. And I met a lovely young blonde, blue-eyed lady from Philadelphia down there. I mean, not that anything ever came of it, but nevertheless.
She looked different.
She looked different. So when I wrote and then the bridge, of course, goes, well, well, she's a sweet little mama with big blue eyes. And, of course, I was going steady that summer with a dark-haired, brown-eyed girl. So every time I'd sing that song, she'd glare at me and say, they're brown.
That's great. That's a great story.
But other than that, it didn't have anything to do with that particular girl. Just that one line about the blue eyes. I know where that line came
from. Yeah. Do you remember that first session?
Now, do you mean the demo session, or do you mean there's a reason. Yes, I remember both sessions.
The session that She's the One for Me was recorded.
Oh, yeah. Do you know who was on that session, Matt? Does the name Dave Baby Cortez ring a bell?
Of course, the happy organ.
Yeah,
Rinky Dink.
Real name, David Clowney. He played piano.
Ooh, you've just exposed him.
What?
You've exposed him.
Yeah. Buddy Lucas, sax player.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah. So, no, they had a good band there. And that's where She's the One for Me was cut. That is not where the release version of You was cut. And therein lies a deep, dark story.
And we're going to get to that story in a moment, but let's pause and hear She's the One for Me, then we're going to flip it over and hear You, the one that was released, and then we'll hear the You that wasn't released, okay?
Works for me.
So She's the One for Me, the original A-side.
Well, she's my baby, my one and only, and I love her so.